Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. The last couple of weeks on the show, we have run the gamut. We've gone from talking about the Galaxy S21 series to rumors about the next generation of 5G. And to bring us back to center this week, I wanted to invite one of my favorite guests. We had him on last April on the show. And this is a guy who he knows a lot about a lot, and he's willing to admit that he's willing to admit the stuff that he doesn't know. And that's why I appreciate him. So I want to welcome back Juan Carlos Bagnell of Some Gadget Guy. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing really good. And I'm really glad to be back. And I've very much enjoyed our conversations in the past. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is an interesting time because I always like to align my guests with a particular theme or event. And there isn't one thing that I wanted you on for this week, except for a video that you put out a few days ago calling yourself scum.
Yeah. And I mean, amongst other folks too.
True.
A little self-reflection never hurt a tech review community, I suppose.
Oh, it definitely hurt many people's feelings. But it's interesting because you're a very self-reflective person. And I think one thing that your community really likes about your content is that you're willing to put yourself on the line on their behalf and admit when we as a community go a little bit too far. So I want to get there at the end. But first, I want to just talk a bit about the current state of things. So 2021 has been a year to forget already in many respects. But from a gadget perspective, there's the Galaxy S21 series. It's come and gone. We've done our reviews, but I haven't talked to you about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start there because I'm currently using a Galaxy S21 Ultra. I'm also reviewing a Galaxy S21 Plus. And what's interesting is that the maxim of never buy a Samsung phone when it's first launched comes back every year because yesterday, as we're recording this Tuesday, February 9th. It was the first time we've seen the S21 series go on sale. So the S21 Ultra is down to 1,000, the S21 Plus is down to 800, and the S21 is down to 700. So $200, $200, and $100 off respectively. And I want to get your sense of, is that the right price for these phones? What do you think about them overall? And where's your head at a month after their release?
I think it's a better price for those phones, but we're kind of caught up in this commentary and then this hype machine, and I feel we're quickly plateauing on this notion of the yearly refresh being aggressive and hype train, and you got to have this. There's some FOMO happening. Maybe you're flipping your phone through your carrier on some kind of lease program, and the S21 kind of highlights to me a trend in Samsung commentary and in Samsung marketing that makes me a little concerned for sort of the diversity of the Android landscape. And I'm not really feeling these phones. The reduced price helps, but we're inclined in the tech review space to sit here and go, whoops, look at this. How generous or how great. What a great deal because these phones launched $200 more. Now you can save some money. When another manufacturer engages in a price cut, we act like that's some kind of critical failure. They couldn't even sell their phone at their launch price, and now they had to cut money. I mean, like, the Duo is currently selling for $400 off on Amazon while we're recording this. And there's a tone of that commentary, like, what a failure. And you're like, yeah, but the Duo held onto its launch price way longer than the Note 20 did, and way longer than the S21 did. So I feel like these MSRPs are somewhat disingenuous. Samsung is going to launch at a higher price. That's the MSRP sticker price that goes to the carrier store that allows the carrier to keep you paying more monthly on a phone that's going to devalue way faster than your contract is going to be up. So if you wait 2 months and you can afford to buy unlocked, you're not going to be upside down on a phone lease 2 months after you buy that phone. So I just feel like it's a moment. It's a good time for us to just kind of look at our commentary. You know, we know that these phones depreciate. We know that they devalue. We know there are going to be sales and BOGOs and trade-ins, but we only seem inclined to put the positive spin on a Samsung product for having great trade-in deals, and we don't recognize the rest of the landscape so fondly whenever we see those price flips. I feel like the Ultra is probably a decent buy. It's a better buy at this price. It kind of puts it in line with wherever we might feel like a OnePlus Pro device might end up. And that's better. That is better. But on the whole, I kind of feel like this generation of Samsung is probably going to be looked back on as being kind of a lateral move. You buy less phone on this generation of Samsung than you did last year.
So that is something that keeps coming up, right? This self-fulfilling prophecy of Samsung setting the baseline for what a flagship phone is in the Android space. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of its lateral moves in 2021 and its subsequent reductions in price, you're almost expecting the competition to follow suit. And right. If they don't, they're going to be viewed as stepping outside the line or going against the grain or whatever idiom you want to use. And I wonder...
Or how greedy, how can you charge more than an S21 for the same processor? And we're going to get stuck on like moving those goalposts. There's one spec sheet, Mark, that you can always point to that's going to be better on a Samsung. And so it's not worth it to consider anything else outside of that, when the reality of this market is it should be broader. It should be more diverse.
Your activism for diversity in the Android space is laudable, because it really is something that you don't hear from in the mainstream very much. And the way that you do it is that you don't follow the same I would say S curve as other tech reviewers, in the sense that when a phone comes out, any phone, the LG Wing, the Xiaomi Mi 11, the Oppo Find X3 Pro, whatever it may be, there is that early hype period, that sort of hump around right before it's announced and right after it's announced when the reviews go live. And then those fade into the background as we wait for the next thing. That's normal. That's something that I know we do as a site. We plan around it. But one thing you do really well is you bring those products back 6 months later, a year later, and you give them a very critical re-review in a way that I don't think, including us, a lot of sites or YouTube channels do particularly well. You say, okay, well, this is the same phone. How is it, you know, how is it using it a month or 6 or 9 months later? But I wonder, the fact that you do go back and use your Galaxy S8 in 2021 or something and actually give it a deep dive, how does that impact how you view new phones as they come out?
It definitely has a chilling effect. We want to think as techies, and I'm assuming that most of your podcast audience is like us, and
I'm sure that's true.
We value the entertainment value of the device itself, as opposed to general consumers who I don't think they're not entertained by the phone. They want to do things on the phone. They want to use different services. We kind of fell into this lockstep trap of being a part of the marketing hype machine for every product that comes out. And I mean, not just reviewers, but also the general tech fan in the smartphone community, because I think we're a very singular, a very unique audience in the world of consumer electronics. And when you go back and when you play with a year-old device, a couple-year-old device, I just ran a first-generation Huawei Nova through my normal slate of like benchmarks and video rendering tests and photo editing, batch processing. And like, that's an almost 5-year-old phone on a Snapdragon 625. And there wasn't anything that phone couldn't do. Like it completed every single one of my tests, from 4K video rendering all the way through like RAR compression. And like, this thing is still a capable handset today. When you really spend some time kind of digging back and forth, you become a lot more sensitive to the claims these manufacturers are making. And this is one of the reasons why I kind of feel, and it's not just on Samsung, but I feel Samsung kind of leans into this because they spend the most on marketing and they make themselves the most visible player in this space, whether or not I feel their devices always deserve that quantity of coverage. We're already getting those early indications that this is going to be kind of another side year for actual real world performance. When we look at how the Snapdragon 888 compares to the 865, you know, my V60 is still outscoring, you know, an S21 Ultra in battery life tests. These are synthetic, and so your real world comparisons are going to be more anecdotal, but that's something I feel consumers are going to care about. When we see they, you know, we can get this burst of performance in a synthetic benchmark, but then these processors start throttling way more aggressively when under sustained use. Then these manufacturers' claims of like, well, this is like the pro camera and the best phone for gaming, they don't really hold up. They don't really hold up to real world scrutiny. And for those of us that are more inclined to flip their phone yearly, or maybe even like every 6 months or every 3 months, it takes a lot of the fun out of this conversation when we're not grading devices by their actual merits. And we're kind of just following the script that we know we need to follow when we're talking about PR relationships, press releases, what the expectations of this community are, and that emotional feel we get when we unbox a new product. Like, no one wants to buy an S21, get excited about the new shiny, then come to my channel and hear me go, yeah, but your frames per second are going to be lower than the phone you had last year if you play for more than 20 minutes. They want me to confirm that the excitement they have is valid. And that's purely emotional. And it's sort of a discord between my review process, which I try to keep it fairly consistent, and their emotional experiences in getting excited or trying out the latest and greatest.
What ends up surprising you then when you get a new phone? What's the thing that makes you really stand behind something, even if it's not from a manufacturer that you would typically find yourself not necessarily defending, but trying to cut through the BS? And maybe give me an example or two of like a product that has really surprised you in a positive way in the last few months.
Yeah, for sure. So my review style hinges a lot on what did the manufacturer claim this thing could do? And that's why the tone of my commentary comes down so critical on Apple and Samsung, because they make outlandish claims about their products. We're 3 years into Apple giving us these unlabeled bar graphs on generational performance improvements. And you're like, the real world application of what you're describing does not resemble these like tentpole logarithmic spike bar graphs that you're showing us. That is not real. And Samsung has kind of leaned into that too. Anything that's profitable for Apple, Samsung seems to piggyback on a year later. And that makes me very disappointed because we've been setting expectations so high, they couldn't possibly live up to those expectations when consumers really get their hands on those products. And we see this over and over and over again. We're another year into these headlines of 9 out of 10 smartphone, you know, 9 out of 10 consumers see no benefit to upgrading their smartphone. And yeah, it's because we keep selling these hyped up improvements that never really manifest for daily driver activities. So the flip side of that is when a company comes in and they've got a fairly, sort of a fairly straightforward approach, or every company wants to highlight the good things about their products and get people excited about them. But there's a huge difference between, like, you know, Apple's talking up pro photography, Samsung saying pro cameras, professional grade cameras. And then you pick up an LG V60 and the tagline was do more. And you're like, it's not even do more better, or, you know, revolutionize your workflow. Or it's like LG isn't even that excited about their dual display. It's just do more at once. And you're like, well, yeah, that's just factually accurate. Like, okay, well, let's see what it can do. And then it actually serves to change my behavior on how I use my phones. My wife would say it cultivated some bad habits where I'm now walking around like running 3 to 4 apps all at the same time anytime I pick up, you know, a dual display device. But it's also when a device seems to push against the common tech reviewer idea. You know, we kind of fall into the trap of, you know, specifically the one I would point to, and we're going to be talking about the OnePlus 9, the OnePlus 8 Pro, I feel got a terrible rap from smartphone reviewers for camera performance. And it's the same thing. We're willing to acknowledge that Samsung always needs a couple months of software tweaks and bug fixes. And that's just the way it is. And isn't it so great how they're giving us these updates? And OnePlus devices have always been the same way. The camera experience pre-embargo is always miserable. And it always takes some time to kind of refine and to kind of get more out of it. And you go and you look at just the specs on the page, and the OnePlus 8 Pro doesn't look that exciting if you're looking at the megapixels. But this is one of the best main camera sensors on any phone from last year. I do believe this is probably the best ultra-wide camera sensor that we got in 2020. It's one of the only phones that is capable of swapping from the ultra-wide to the main camera sensor while shooting 4K 60, software stabilized. And the macro performance is very, very good. There are so many aspects of this phone that can run it right up against the best that Huawei has to offer in a lot of these points where we would normally point to Huawei as being indomitable in camera tech. But the common knowledge is OnePlus cameras suck. And I used a OnePlus 6T and the cameras were miserable. And so I think they just need to work on getting better cameras. If their cameras just worked, then they would be worth it. But no one went and did that testing. No one went and did that deep dive. No one compared the awful HDR performance on the Note 20 against the surprisingly decent contrasty HDR performance on the OnePlus 8 Pro. And so we're happy to repeat these truisms even long past the point where they were really true. Beyond that, it's also just I want something a bit more experiential. So I think one of my happiest surprises of last year wasn't even directly a phone, but a phone augmentation accessory, the FIO BTR5. So many phones lacking headphone jacks, having this one little pocket DAC that can drive surprisingly thirsty headphones, can work over a USB-C cable, supports all of the advanced codecs for Bluetooth, can move very quickly between a tablet, a desktop, a laptop, or a smartphone. I mean, like, that really felt like, man, if we're going to lose out on the practicality of a headphone jack, here's this one little Swiss Army knife of an audio gadget that just solved all of these problems for me. And it's quietly off on the side, just going like, hey, by the way, if you love your ears, I'm over here. And I just feel like I need to write more love letters to this product because it solves so many practical problems for people out there with this trend in removing features from premium devices.
Yeah, we just published an article this morning, and the cheeky title is OnePlus 9 and 9 Pro will one-up the Galaxy S21 by shipping with a charger. and I'm just like, how far we've fallen.
Yeah.
How low is this bar that I'm having my, I mean, it needed to be written because it's a real story, but how sad is it that I have to get my news team to write an article about how OnePlus is going to do the thing that they've done every year. And that's somehow disruptive because Apple and Samsung did it. And I guess Xiaomi did it too.
And the flip side of that too is I just couldn't understand why more people weren't, I mean, we're nerds, right? So this is deep in the weeds, and I'm not expecting my mom, who's on a OnePlus 6T, to get lit up about this. But I was shocked that more techies weren't at least a little bit positive on the actual charger that we got with the OnePlus 8T. It's a 45-watt power delivery laptop charger in the box.
And it's like, PPS. It's better than any charger Samsung's released for its own phones that actually support PPS. It's insane.
Right? And you know, that is not a revolutionary idea. That's not a make or break selling point, right? I'm not telling someone to go out and buy a OnePlus 8T because of the charger that comes in the box, but what a nice perk. And at least to approach it with the positivity of like, hey, it's always a conversation about pros and cons, you know, these benefits and compromises. What a nice little perk that you open the box and not only is this thing awesome on the phone, but it's one of the few that actually does a good job of charging my Chromebook. You know, like that's handy. That is a consumer benefit that I feel deserves some part of that conversation. But instead, we're going to go, oh, but wireless charging. No, it doesn't have the wireless charging. It's a fail, bro. It's a fail. And you're like, it's so reductive. And it makes the tech conversation so obnoxious.
I mean, one thing we are not lacking is obnoxiousness in the tech reviewer space. And I avail myself of that as well. But I do want to ask, you, before we move on to the OnePlus 9 stuff,
for sure,
I do want to talk a little bit about a video you put out about the Pixel 5, because I want to stick on cameras for a sec. And this was late January. It was right after the S21 reviews. And you kind of put it out as a counter argument to the notion that the S21 Ultra and the iPhone 12 Pro Max leapfrogged ahead of the Pixel 5 in every measure. In fact, we don't even have to review it next to the Pixel 5 anymore because it's just so far ahead, it's not even in the conversation.
For sure.
And you put out a video that showed the Pixel 5 in various situations up against the, you know, a big sensor phone like the Xperia One Mark II. I never get that name right. You also put it up against what was the other one? The OnePlus 8 Pro. Okay, so bigger
I props
sensor
for our podcast. I know it's an audio Amazing. Show, but yeah, I'm gonna carrot top this podcast.
He's holding the phones up. I'll give you some closed captioning. and the results were obviously meant to show that the Pixels are still in the conversation, right? Mm-hmm. Pixel 5 is still a good performer. Doesn't win in every lighting environment or when you need that shallow depth of field.
And nor should it. I mean, we're talking about significant price differences between these devices.
Yeah. But I wonder what you would say to people who, you know, are reportedly grading the Samsung and Apple phones on a curve. Mm-hmm. And we're not as generous with the Pixel 5 necessarily this year because of its maybe because it changed where it was in relation to the competition, right? It was necessarily
That's totally fair. I have a philosophical problem with Google calling this the 5 when last year's 4 was a different market position. So I feel like the name, that's absolutely something We should be critical of how Google branded and has been marketing their devices. But that's different than completely cutting a phone out of a conversation and going out of your way to say, we're going out of our way to cut the Pixel 5 out. And that's really the problem I have with the tone of these Samsung and Apple camera discussions is, if you want to make a Samsung review, review the camera. If you can't make a review without talking about three other phones, that's not a review, that's a comparison. And so they're making this big point and this big spectacle out of slamming the Pixel. And I'm not entirely sure why. Why did you feel it necessary to go out of your way to trash the Pixel in a Samsung review? And the only thing I can come up with is we need to find ways to make Samsung owners feel better about their phones. I mean, that's really the only reason I can see to go that hard on a competing device when you don't need to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the fact that, in my opinion, I reviewed the Pixel 5 and found the lack of year-over-year improvement again to be a bit of a bummer. And yet, I totally understand it from the perspective of somebody looking at it as a cheaper option over the Pixel 4 or, you know, something in the $1,000 or $1,500
range.
Right,
because year-over-year improvements also don't really come with $200 price reductions when we're looking at all of the comparable features. That like we see with Samsung, we should be looking at more compromises and a lateral move whenever we see those prices fall. But Samsung got a bunch of positive headlines. Wow, the S21 base model price is $200 less than last year. And everyone was after Google's throat for making a lesser than device from Pixel 4 to Pixel 5. And again, it's we're leaning into a commentary here that's being bolstered by a hype machine generated by a company that spends $10 billion a year advertising their label. I'm sorry, I know like I get soapboxy about this stuff, but to kind of come back to that camera conversation, I think the thing that's been frustrating is how often we lazily conflate different experiences based on some kind of number. So like Samsung is technically correct in calling their sensor a 108 megapixel sensor, but that's a 9:1 subpixel compression to spit out a 12 megapixel image. And so when we make this big, huge claim, and then we also review these products in a very simplistic auto HDR, only push the shutter button kind of way, we're telling consumers how impressive. But the final result is going to be pretty similar if that consumer is shooting the same way on their new phone that they were shooting on their old phone. And when we really put these products head to head, the difference in sensor size between what the Pixel 5 has and the iPhone 12 Pro and the Galaxy S21 Ultra, those sensor sizes aren't as significant as the move from like micro four thirds to APS-C to full frame. And even then, you can have these really in-depth camera conversations talking about like, well, I mean, we're talking about depth of field, we need this focal length, and honestly, sensor size doesn't contribute to this as much, but what you're looking at is light acquisition or depth of field. I mean, you know, we can get granular on other products. For some reason on smartphones, it's still kind of locked in this megapixel sort of champion. Like, this number bigger, so that number better, and that's what we care about. Because if we were really hyped up and we were really upset about the Pixel 5's camera sensor size, then I kind of feel that we need to share some of that ire with the iPhone 12 Pro, which has the same camera sensor size. And Apple doesn't delineate that on their spec sheet. They don't tell you there's a difference between the 12 Pro and the 12 Pro Max. Oh, LiDAR and some of these other radar features. But no, there's a physical sensor size difference that is not detailed by Apple when you go to their spec sheet. And I feel that's intellectually dishonest. Those are different camera experiences. And so why are we so upset about a Pixel at $699 when an iPhone 12 Pro at $999 has very similar optics? Why is this only focused in one direction?
This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed. Podcasts are a small business. When we're talking to business owners, we get it 100%. And when it comes to hiring, every single hire needs to fit just right. Our team is tiny. One wrong move could destroy us. And that's why we're telling you about Indeed. Indeed.com is the hiring site that helps you find quality candidates with Indeed Instant Match. Indeed searches through the millions of resumes in their database to help show you great candidates instantly. So you can do the part you really need faster, meeting and hiring great people. Unlike some hiring sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility, delivering a quality shortlist faster. With Indeed, there are no long-term contracts. You can pause your account at any time, and you only pay for what you need. With Instant Match, you see a list of great candidates with zero wait. And Indeed delivers four times more hires than all other job sites combined, according to Talent Nest. Do you want your quality shortlist fast? You need Indeed right now. Our listeners get a free $75 credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/ACP. That's Indeed.com/ACP. This is Indeed's best offer anywhere. Get a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. Offer valid through March 31st. Terms and conditions apply.
I have a question about, you know, you often in your videos bring up the fact that we're only using like we're using the 10% of our brain style, you know, comparison to in smartphones, in the sense that like, if you're only opening the camera app and shooting with auto HDR turned on, you're really not taking advantage of the full spectrum of image signal processing capabilities. And I agree with that. And I think LG has spoken in many, many areas, both on its product itself and in its marketing, about how it leans into pro. And you have shown that in your output on your channel.
But Google does not do that. Google does not give you a pro mode. It really kind of hides any pro features from you to some extent. The, you know, its raw capture is kind of a little bit hidden. It's not as hidden as it used to be.
Right.
HDR plus is turned on by default, and you're mm-hmm. not really sure what it's doing anymore because they're using the same nomenclature, but it's doing very different things than it was doing a few years ago. And I wonder, you know, the iPhone and iOS in general, the iPhone is a very simple camera app, but it has this enormous ecosystem of third-party camera alternatives mm-hmm. that have access to a very, very comprehensive API. On the Pixel side, that is just not the case because Camera 2 API is not as comprehensive, and the third-party camera app ecosystem just isn't there in the same way on Android. And I wonder how you feel about that, because on a Samsung phone or an LG phone, there is an explicit pro mode.
Yeah.
You need to take advantage of those features. On a Pixel, though, even if Google thinks that the post-processing is what makes the camera as good as it is, it's still not really letting you tinker. And I wonder, should we be deducting points or being critical of Google for that? Or like, what's your take on it?
You know, actually, what I'm happy with is leaving the sort of core iOS and Pixel camera app experience as the baseline, and then adding points to phones that give us more capabilities. And it's sort of the opposite way that DxO reviews their cameras, because they just shoot full auto. You never get any of the other experience of how those cameras can function outside of open app, push shutter button. And I feel like that's reductive. So we shouldn't be scoring that as the top and then working down. I feel we should be taking the Pixel and then grading up when there is some other consumer benefit for someone who might want to push those limits a little bit further. You know, the Pixel 5 is interesting, and your point about the camera API is very well taken. But I've also had some pretty decent experiences with a Manual Camera Pro, with Filmic and First Light. Like, there is a little bit more you can dig into, and I feel we as tech reviewers could probably be highlighting some of those options a little bit better.
Totally.
But also, it comes back to my stance on the marketing. Apple is going to bend over backwards to talk about their devices as professional grade cinematography solutions. And out of the box, it's no different than picking up a Pixel. And you have to go through Apple's style of workflow, Apple's accessories, and the App Store to find those other solutions that are going to suit your workflow. Out of the box, the Pixel 5 actually has some interesting new tricks that I hope will be better implemented with maybe a return to a more powerful SoC. But, you know, like the new options for video stabilization are really well considered. Again, it's not just, can I smooth out the video? It's, can I customize the video stability in a way that contributes to a very specific kind of camera move? And that's a totally different conversation than any other manufacturer has been having outside of like an LG Wing or what's the Oppo with the built-in gimbal? I can't remember now.
Oh, the Reno 5 something,
where,
I want to say.
Again, that is a very specific kind of camera conversation to have with a narrow range of consumers that care about that style of videography. And now here it is on a Pixel 5, and it works surprisingly well on that Pixel 5. So Google's claim has never been, we're trying to make a pro cinematography device. It's never been, you're going to shoot movies on a Pixel. It's never been, this is the premier professional grade camera experience. They've always focused on the most streamlined, consumer accessible, easy to use type of solution. And to that, I feel they live up to those claims very well. I grade them higher because their marketing is in line with the experiences I find in using that camera, where I can't say the same thing about Apple. I don't like the changes that Apple has been making to post-processing since the iPhone X and leaning into a more computational HDR style of photography that doesn't look as good in a lot of lighting conditions. I don't like the new iOS camera app. I feel it's busier and you get weird duplications of features on the left side of the viewfinder to the right side of the viewfinder. You have to tuck away more menu options because iOS settings are garbage and you don't want to have to go into the phone settings to control things in the camera app.
I still can't
app.
Believe that's a thing.
So we're so happy to grade Apple on this sort of familiarity curve when Apple is making some changes that I don't think improve the actual ergonomic experience of using your phone as a camera. And again, I feel those changes are better represented on a Pixel. And if your focus, because I don't shoot on Pixels like I do on Sony's or LG's, but I can still at least, you know, sort of, I don't want to use the word like commiserate, but I can still sort of acknowledge when I put this phone in my wife's hands, this is going to empower her to shoot better content than she could on her old LG G7. This streamlined workflow, the less clutter on your viewfinder, menus that are so much better organized for things like controlling your video resolution and your frame rate, all of these are practical and tangible benefits for her style of content creation, for capturing moments with our daughter. So that's where I get lit up. I mean, I feel Google made a claim and then nailed it, whereas I feel Apple and Samsung are making much bolder claims and falling short of their marketing.
Okay. That's fair. And I think that kind of rounds out the conversation for the past a little bit. And I want to talk about I would talk about this all day, but I only have you for an hour. So I want to talk about the OnePlus 9 a little bit.
Yeah.
We have a little bit more information about these phones now, the OnePlus 9, 9 Pro, 9e. We're expecting them to be the next big launch in North America. There's the Mi 11, which just hit in Europe. But I still haven't seen it. I'm excited to try it, but I have never used a Xiaomi phone. So I don't know much about it other than I wish I had it. And I guess OnePlus is in an interesting place today because it just released the N10 5G and the N100, which were, to put it bluntly, very disappointing in terms of what they brought to the table, I thought. But I was I was being a little hard on OnePlus because I wasn't sure what a $200 OnePlus phone or a $300 OnePlus phone would look like. Mm-hmm. I haven't yet come to my full conclusion around the N10 for 5G, especially after I used the Moto G Stylus, which is a $300 phone that's worse, objectively worse in almost way than the N10 5G.
I haven't spent much time with the N100, and TK Bay actually has done some pretty decent coverage on the N100, but I was very pleasantly surprised with the N10 because I would ask, what other phone at $299 full retail? And again, there have already been sales and carrier deals on the N10 that price it significantly less. But what other phone at $299 with 5G is a stronger recommendation?
There isn't one, and I agree. It's that I found that it chugged a little bit. I felt it was a little clunky. I felt the camera output was pretty disappointing.
But full MSRP, you're talking about a Stylo 6.
Sure. Exactly.
So I feel like I am way less conflicted at someone who comes and like, maybe they don't have the credit to get a zero interest loan on a $1,000 phone and they got to pay up front. I feel way less conflicted about recommending that Nord at $299, but hopefully less than I did a Stylo 6 at $299 and should have been priced way less.
Yeah, LG's entry level phones are still disasters, but I think my misgivings were around software, around the promise of only a single update. Mm-hmm. Same with Motorola. This happens every year. I wish OnePlus took software updates more seriously. They've been falling a little bit behind. But so we'll leave the entry-level stuff for a moment. We're coming from the AT, which was a really solid release. I really liked the AT. I thought it was great. We're going to three phones now, and I would not expect prices to rise for any of them. If I had my...
I'm really hoping,
You know, if I had my prediction hat on, I would say $699, $899 again for the 8, for the 9 and 9 Pro, and maybe $599 or $500 for the 9e. I don't know what that phone is going to be.
Right.
But let's take a look at the
at what we want out of these devices, right? What do you want out of a OnePlus Trio in 2021 that you can't get from any of the other manufacturers?
I feel like this year is going to be a refinement year for everybody. The S21 takes significant step back in just feature set. You know, there, you lose features on an S21 over an S20 the year before. So when we start seeing like what Qualcomm has been able to enable in improving radio connectivity and getting that modem back on the SoC so it's not a separate component, I'm hoping that we see some of those less exciting but real world practical benefits to battery life, to radio reception. From what testing I could do, going from the 855 to the 865 was either a sidestep or made performance worse for Wi-Fi and LTE. Now, as we're starting to get a little bit more sub-6 5G out there, now's the right time to kind of tinker, to refine, to tweak, and to bring some of those improvements to the forefront. I'm a little concerned that the high-performance core that's going to be put into these phones is going to make battery life worse in these short bursts sort of activity that the focus on a single big core is going to lead to. But if there's any company that I feel can refine for that and keep their devices feeling really snappy, I'm hoping OnePlus can show us that there is a benefit for spending $899 or $999 on that Pro, opposite where we might be with the early days of the Xiaomi, where there are some conversations happening about performance and stability, app crashing, stuff like that. I'm still very confident that the first 2 months of the OnePlus 9 Pro were going to be, as we wait for a little bit of polish. But right. I'm not really hoping to see a lot of crazy new features. I hope they keep the same camera sensor, because the camera sensor on the OnePlus 8 Pro is phenomenal. I hope they keep the same ultra wide, because it is still one of the all-time best ultra-wide sensors I've ever used. We do need a bit of a tweak to the telephoto. That's where the performance, I think, is weakest on the OnePlus 8 Pro. And then after that, it's pretty feature complete. We've already had, you know, quad HD at 120 hertz, so keep that. There's no reason to whittle that back. There's no reason to whittle back on screen resolution on your Pro, your premium device. We've already had fast wireless charging and reverse wireless charging, and we'll get that upgrade to the charger so it'll take advantage of the same charger tech as the 8T. And I'm okay with the 9 Pro being subtle refinements all around to just sort of polish up the experience that I already really liked on the OnePlus 8 Pro.
I would also say that by adding a third model this year, it does take a little bit of the pressure off OnePlus to be, you know, they've got something else to point at as sort of their down market, their down market baby, so to speak, right? Like if they, it's doing what Samsung's doing. They're expanding as well as sort of lowering the floor a little bit for entry, yeah. And they can tell people, you know, this is our full lineup of flagship products. This is where we're going to stand behind. But if the OnePlus 9 Pro is not that massive upgrade that people want out of a product year over year, I think it'll be more understandable, because OnePlus will be able to point to market pressures and people not having as much disposable income and being like, yeah, look, this is all we could do with the budget we have. By the way, now we have a really cheap phone for you. Well, we have two really cheap phones,
right,
a slightly cheaper phone, a pretty inexpensive phone, and a flagship. And that's not confusing at all. But
you know, what I would love any manufacturer to do, and I feel like OnePlus is actually one of the few labels that could pull off this direct of a conversation, is to point out just how niche these premium devices are. They occupy most of our tech commentary because they're the exciting devices, they're the luxury car, super sports car devices. The price tags are outlandish, so there's something salacious in that commentary. But Galaxy A grossly outsells Galaxy S. You know, LGK grossly outsells LGV. You know, like this isn't rocket surgery here. Like this is basic understandings of the bell curve of a consumer market. And so there's something I think really exciting. I would love for OnePlus to stop doing the T series as some sort of mid-year refresh, have their lineup go at the beginning of the year with the number variant, and then have the Nord follow as the more budget-friendly in the second half of the year. And OnePlus has a good conversation starter throughout the year. But I think there's something awesome about, let's say, starting prices, 9 Pro, $899, 9 at $699, 9e at $499, Nord at $299. I mean, like, how great would it be if you could just $200, just make it $200 price tiers, and it would be such a simple, straightforward lineup to understand, sure, as opposed to the, you know, like the overlapping of FEs versus Galaxy A's versus Galaxy S's. And oh no, now there's this new crown jewel of folds and flips, and like, it's kind of a mess. And you're just sort of bombarded by all this stuff. I would love to see OnePlus streamline focus and then just really have that conversation. The OnePlus 9 Pro is not a mainstream daily driver, get your social media done kind of phone that takes you up to a trim package in a luxury car that is going to be for a small part of our overall consumer base. But you shouldn't feel left out because the feature set and the experience travels all the way down to like our $299 devices as well. I would love for someone to go out on stage and just break that down and say, like, you know, here are all the videos that came out on $1,000 plus phones. And now here are all the consumers that really represent that market. Who are you talking to?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the idea of being a creator on your phone. And I mean, that's the two angles that I think a lot of these high-end phones are taking in their marketing is gaming, right? If you're a premium gamer and you spend time on your phone playing real games, like, come on, you're playing Stadia or Game Pass, or you're playing like Minecraft or Terraria
or COD, you know, like Call of Duty. Actually, the mobile numbers in that are pretty decent too. But yeah,
I'm not undermining the fact that people are playing games. I'm saying that Call of Duty Mobile plays perfectly fine on a Pixel 5 with a Snapdragon 765.
Right.
You do not need a Snapdragon 865 Plus or an 888 to get the best experience from Call of Duty Mobile. That is always going to be true of mobile gaming because they have to build for the lowest common Android denominator. They will always make a game playable on a $200 phone. It has to be.
Yeah. And I feel like they make the nicest version of that start at the peak of the bell curve. So in your 600 series and 700 series Snapdragons, you're going to be good. You know, Activision doesn't want to leave out the majority on the smartphone ecosystem from being able to play that game.
One thing, I mean, look, I'll take a little bit of a tangent here because there was one gaming experience I had that sort of surprised me. I was in the Diablo Immortal technical alpha, and I was playing it on my Galaxy S20 Plus. I started my character on that phone because I was using it before the S21 came out, and I just wanted to see what it was like. And the characters weren't transferable, so I couldn't, when I put my SIM in another phone, I was like, crap, I don't want to start over. I'm going to continue playing it on this phone. So the S65 series had a high frame rate option in the settings that wasn't there on the 765 on my Pixel 5, which makes total sense. It increased it to 60 frames per second. Interestingly, the technical alpha did not give the iPhone the same 60 FPS option. At all on any of the iPhones. And I found that kind of fascinating. But it was really cool being able to play this game at 60 frames per second and being like, okay, this is what the extra GPU power is giving me on this game. And it made a massive difference to my experience. And I loved it. It was definitely a reason to get a higher end phone. And it was like, I don't play a lot of mobile games. So that was one of those instances where I was like, oh, cool. This is kind of nice that I spent all this money on a phone and it's finally, giving me a reason to enjoy it.
Isn't this exactly why we should be talking about phones a bit more like we talk about laptops? You know, if my great aunt comes to me and says she needs to replace her old busted laptop, I'm not going to say, well, you know, come here, aunt, you need like a $6,000 gaming rig. you know, you need a flagship laptop, not one of those mid-ranger laptops. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So, you know, like in those kinds of experiences, we also kind of tend to belittle some of the good work that's being done by developers that are bringing these experiences to mobile, like Children of Light, some pretty good settings to like improve fidelity or to increase frame rate. There's a developer called 10 Tons. They make Switch games for the Nintendo Switch that are like these dual stick shooters, but they've been porting them to Android. And when you go through and you click on all of the little performance options, the lighting effects, the bloom effects, the sparkle effects, everything else, like you're actually ending up with a better version of that game on an Android device, in my opinion, than what you could play on a Nintendo Switch. And so when we kind of just shuffle this stuff, and again, we sort of use these reviewer truisms like, oh, you're playing games or doing this or doing that, we kind of end up watering down what those benefits might be when you do climb higher. And at the same time, we watch all these reviews that are talking about $1,000, $1,200, $1,500 phones, and they're showing experiences that are perfectly well represented at $400 and less. And that's not really contributing much to a conversation outside of just sort of amplifying sort of marketing speak from the press releases that we get. And if we can't sort of acknowledge that in our community, then we end up with the same commentary. We end up with that Reddit joke that happened at our expense. And then we complain that, oh, well, tech is getting boring. If you're trying to do more with your phone, tech has never been more exciting. If you're really in Samsung and you're not using DeX, you're missing out on one of the most capable portable computing experiences around. If you're not looking at like the advanced camera settings on a Sony that totally line up with their Alpha series of mirrorless cameras, you're really missing out. If you're not plugging headphones into your LG, your ears are missing out. And that's not what we really want to talk about. We want to talk about like Snapchat filters or something. I don't know what it is. I mean, at this point, I don't even know what tech reviewers are doing on their phones, except for talking about their phones. And then that seems to be about it. And so that makes me very cranky because I got into this to try and displace other devices. Like I want a phone that means I have to open up my laptop less. I get cranky if I have to do something at a workstation or at a laptop because I can't do it on my phone. You know, so that's where I want to try and drive some of this because that's the only thing that's going to get people out of this funk. You know, I don't want to upgrade my phone. It's not going to do anything different. Well, are you trying to do anything different? Because if you're not trying, then yeah, it's going to be exactly the same as the phone you're retiring.
I think we've had 10, 11, 12 years with smartphones now, and we're all in that fixed mind frame, that unchanging workflow of this is what we do on our phones. And us as media are showing you how to do the same thing year after year.
Mm-hmm.
We're not necessarily showing you what you can do that's new and interesting.
Well, and it's definitely a problem of analytics because if the audience, if the consumers aren't searching for that stuff, then YouTube isn't going to just give it to them. And so it creates this echo chamber popularity cycle where we end up talking about the same things over and over and over again because a smaller and smaller audience of people are regularly tuning into that commentary. And it's getting more and more difficult to broaden out. It's getting harder and harder to get people on board. I still have people that are coming to like my LG G7 and BlackBerry Key 2 reviews because these devices have lasted for a lot longer than tech reviewers really gave them credit for. And they're just now finding some of my commentary on those devices from being several years out. That's the problem we're facing is because there's a definite gatekeeper on social media in between us and our potential audiences. And it's so much more difficult to try and show, you know, like, hey, I want to show you some advanced decks. Well, who's searching for it? If no one's searching for advanced decks, then you're not just going to pop up in someone's recommendations. And so Google is literally going to get in the way of who might be able to find that video because it's less search popular. And so if we can't kind of course correct for some of these issues and we can't try to reach out and find a broader community of potential consumers outside of our little echo chamber, then our community is just going to continue to sort of wither and whittle down as people sort of leave our ranks, but we're not finding new people to replenish our ranks.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I found on like when scrolling through TikTok is that it's a very different experience than scrolling through Instagram, because my generation of people are creating content for Instagram for people like me. And I'm right. creating content for people like my peers on Instagram. Whereas on TikTok, I feel like the expectations are very different. And I wonder if we need a TikTok version of tech reviews for people who are just coming now to learn how to use their phones in ways that don't resemble us old folks, us 30-somethings. And it's not just here's how to create content on TikTok. It's literally here's how to use your phone to do more in a day, which happens to be building great content on TikTok, but it's also here's how to, you know, do your work in ways that you may have thought only are possible on your laptop, or, you know, a lot of the stuff that you do, which I give you a lot of credit for. You dig into, you know, editing videos on your LG phones. And I think that's fantastic.
But I'll also say that my style of commentary is like the least successful way that you can have a YouTube channel. Like if you're really interested in making money, like don't follow my lead, but it's discouraging. It's disheartening because I'll send a video to a family member, a relative or a friend of mine, and I'll get that really great, kind of reaction or response. Just recently, you know, we got a whole flood of stories about the new iOS beta that is going to pair with the Apple Watch to help improve face unlock. Because sure. I still think Face ID is a dumb thing to make the core of your biometric security. I think you should have both face unlock and a fingerprint sensor. That's me. So many of my Android using brethren and relatives had no idea about features like smart lock. And right. We've been in a pandemic for a year, and even I kind of fell down on like, hey, it's kind of a pain if you have a Pixel 4 and you want to, you know, unlock your phone out in public, or you work in an industry where you have to wear gloves and you can't use the fingerprint sensor. What are you going to do? And, you know, just putting out this video yesterday, like so many people, I had no idea. Hey, cool. Look at that. And you're like, well, we dedicated all this time to an iOS beta in the general media to amplify Apple's marketing. And yet here was this practical consumer benefit that's already on most Android devices that you could take advantage of today, and it doesn't get brought up, and it doesn't get mentioned, and it doesn't get highlighted. And so those types of circles are just exceedingly difficult to break out of. And to your point, I mean, like, it might even mean these conversations need to happen on other platforms. Like, my Twitch numbers are getting better, and my monetization on Twitch is getting better. And Twitch is a miserable platform for discovering produced video content. And yet I'm starting to find traction in people going through my clips on Twitch, just looking for other kinds of conversations to have when it comes to consumer electronics.
So I wanna touch on that Reddit thread a little bit.
Yeah, let's do it. I've got time too. I know, you probably have things that, you know, you're kind of locked in on too, but I got a little time I can float you if we wanna extend this remix.
Let's just talk about it a little bit. So this is a thread in a subreddit called Starter Packs, or our Starter Packs. And this idea is that they put together clips of images and text from various places to put starter packs of basically an archetype. So, you know, you have a Disney fan archetype or Disney fan starter pack. You have an online class starter pack. You have a TV shows when the characters go to the good timeline starter pack.
Amazing. I like that one. That one was funny, actually.
Suburban Asian family starter pack. Like, these are all, it's comedy. It's funny. And this one that just roasted tech reviewers was called the YouTube Tech Reviewer Starter Pack. And I will link it in the show notes. It's hysterical.
So it is really
not
funny.
Only is, you know, everybody says, like, they're making a video around building their own gaming PC. They wear the same sweatshirt. They wear the same glasses. They compare two photos side by side that look exactly the same, but they're like, you can clearly see the huge difference in camera quality. I was literally lolling when I read this, when I saw this thread. But I, you know, you posted about this and we're very upfront about how this is how they see us.
Yeah.
This is how normies see tech reviewers as just in, we're in our own, we are just
believing our own bullshit, for lack of a better term. And I'd love to get your impression and why you thought you needed to respond to this community, because yours was the only response that I thought was really thoughtful.
Well, like so many of my reviews now, there's a component of this that I don't feel I can talk about a product without also addressing some of the media literacy surrounding the market that that product lives in. Oftentimes, it's a very antagonistic conversation about, you know, the largest companies manipulating the conversation. But there are also times where it's just, you know, I miss the glee that our community used to kind of foster. And I miss some of the fun way back in the Wild West days of like Palm versus Windows Mobile and versus BlackBerry and Symbian. And when we had more competition, and when we look at those trends over, you know, 12 years of portable computing and portable electronics, some of the things that I kind of highlight are examples of that Reddit starter pack. So someone shared it on my Discord, and we all had a really good laugh at my expense, because even I fall into some of those traps. But when I saw that it had hit the front page of Reddit, which starter packs aren't always the kind of content that you'll see like up in the top 10 posts on the Reddit front page, and that it was a tech-focused starter pack, because techie stuff is usually sort of relegated to a bit of a scroll on the front page of Reddit. Like, you have to kind of dig through some stuff before you start seeing Android headlines on the front page of Reddit. There was just something different about that joke. And it kind of prompted me to go through those comments, and the comments are savage. And I feel like there's a part of it where we have fun talking about tech in a very particular way, and our community can be very insular. Looking from the outside, it just sounded like a lot of people that were frustrated by the kind of tropes of our community, and then probably people that had been burned by the commentary of our community, sort of moving the goalposts for one manufacturer or over another, or talking about lesser devices in a very derogatory or reductive way. And, you know, it definitely spoke to something that I've also personally been frustrated in. At the same time, highlighting those numerous examples of when I've probably contributed to commentary that I would look back now on and cringe. And so I tend to kind of go on the attack in my videos and reviews more than I probably should, because I don't have much of an interest in courting a traditional Reddit branded tech audience. Often in my videos, I purposely antagonize so that I can cut out comments that I know are going to be problematic when I'm talking about certain devices. And I want to get to a point, and you'll see this a lot. If one of my videos is ever shared on Reddit, it's almost always like, well, he makes a point, but oh, his tone. I just don't like his tone. And that's by design. Because if I don't immediately cut the arguments off at the knees, then my comments are garbage. And I don't want garbage comments on my videos. I want to have a conversation that's, you know, a bit more interesting than just some other YouTuber said this phone was garbage. You know, like, I don't care. So I'm going to purposely go out of my way of making that person feel unwelcome in my comments. It kind of spoke, again, in having a laugh at my own expense. I've personally got to find things that are more fun. The sort of edgy or aggressive tint to my reviews is getting exhausting, because it doesn't really seem to improve the conversation with techies. They still come at me with the same sort of, you know, fanboy, poorly thought out arguments, or they just sit there and clutch their pearls that I'm being so mean and my tone is so aggressive. And I'm having so much more fun finding some of those few opportunities to bring up conversations from people outside of our tech circles. And like, when I get in a conversation on my Discord, or when I find a really great comment thread on one of my videos, that's what I'm doing this for. So the starter pack was sort of that existential kick up the rear that I needed. And then also, when I started sharing it, and when I started pointing out to some of my friends, like, this is what they're saying about us, I saw a lot of head nodding. A lot of folks going like, man, I've not been having fun. This has not been fun for a while. And this really highlighted all the reasons why. And so I don't feel like our differences are that severe. People inside the smartphone tech community and people outside, I feel like we're both kind of frustrated about the same thing. It's just who's going to move first? Like, who's going to make the effort to kind of change up the conversation that we have?
Well, I mean, the conversation is working for the people at the top. And yeah. then there's this GameStonk argument, right? Is that if you right. as long as you start buying as the line is going up and to the right, you're going to make money.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually that's going to plateau, and then you're going to
buy
some, a lot of people are going to buy right at the top, and you're going to end up losing money. And that's what happened to GameStonk, and it's been happening to YouTube tech YouTube, in the sense that there are more people starting tech YouTube channels now than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
And they are having a very difficult time differentiating their content, and their audiences just are not. I know personally, I only have 20 minutes a day, say, for YouTube. I have to allocate my time to those four or five minute videos that I like and trust and want to watch. Mm-hmm. And I know that if you or Rene Ritchie or Mr. Mobile or MKBHD or any of the top YouTubers that I follow are going to put out a video, I can watch like four regular videos or one Rene Ritchie video. It's kind of, it's up to me.
I have to like budget my Rene Ritchie to like once a week because yeah. I'm not super into iOS, and you know, like I know exactly what I'm going to get from him. And he was like, oh, I'm going to learn something from a Rene Ritchie.
Yeah, exactly. It's like homework. I love it, but it's homework. But yeah, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's just that it's very difficult. And then to discover what YouTube does relatively well, at least the algorithm does relatively well for tech YouTube, is every once in a while it'll point me to a really great up-and-coming creator.
Yeah.
And I'll discover them. But most of the time, if I've just watched a Some Gadget Guy video, it's going to give me another Some Gadget Guy video,
yeah.
or it's going to give me a Marques Brownlee video or a Dave2D video that is in the same category, and it's not showing me a lot of new people. So I get it, and that's the problem, is that there it's very difficult, and I'm friends with some of these up-and-coming creators who have had a very difficult time growing their audience.
And it's by design in a way that highlights to the benefit of companies like Samsung and Apple. Samsung gets to use our communities, our various channel audiences, to shotgun blast as much content about their new phone launch as possible, because they don't care about our audience. They're hoping that someone from outside the general tech sphere will stumble onto any one of these videos from all of these different creators that all launch at the same embargo date. So for them, it's this beautiful spread that just saturates YouTube and makes it a trending topic and makes it more likely that someone from outside the smartphone community will catch it, at the expense of the communities that we try to build and we try to foster. And it's very, I mean, to your point, it is extremely difficult if you're an up-and-coming channel. I don't know how to better tell YouTube, I want to find new tech voices. Every time I click subscribe on someone with 1,000 subscribers or less, they are right under my nose. Like, if you like tech, you should follow Unbox Therapy. Like, YouTube, I have told you I am not interested in seeing Unbox Therapy in my recommendations. Oh, well, then you need to follow this other. He has 10 million subscribers. I don't care. I just clicked on a channel with 600 subs. Who else you got that's like that? Because that's what I'm telling you I want. And so, I mean, I know I've kind of plugged this around before too, but like I made a little Reddit community. I reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. And it's only got 1,500 members. It's totally grassroots. It's all homegrown. But if you compare your YouTube recommendations list with the breadth of content creators that you'll find on this tiny little subreddit, I think you'll get a different impression on what tech YouTube really has to offer. I think you'll find a broader community, a more international community. I've learned so much about the Indian market from following some of the videos that people have posted from channels that YouTube really doesn't have any interest in putting under my nose. If you're into tech, not just into one brand, but if you're into tech, it's kind of on us to do a better job of sharing and supporting those players, and not even just like, oh, this person only has 400 subscribers, I'm going to try and blow them up on Twitter. It's also the larger channels that maybe haven't adapted to changes in the YouTube algorithm as well. Maybe they're not getting the audience that they probably deserve to be getting for their consistency or their review style. So I at least tried, I mean, however successful it might be, I at least tried to do something to kind of talk about that and to highlight it. But if we leave it to YouTube, we're only going to keep getting more of the same. And I feel, again, it's to the detriment of our actual community, the people who really do care about this stuff.
Yeah, I really like Glowing Rectangles, our Glowing Rectangles. I will plug it as well, because I think everybody here should subscribe to it.
Oh, thanks,
if you're listening to the Android Central podcast, I feel like you're going to get something out of Glowing Rectangles. I think the audiences are very much aligned. So
I really appreciate that. And it's a labor of love. It's really, really a little community. It needs all the help it can get with the upvotes in the comments. But we've been seeing some very interesting posts coming up too, of people just like, hey, I'm not a tech reviewer, but I just got this new phone and here are my thoughts on it. And it tends to read in a very different way than some of the larger communities that can kind of echo chamber a bit more aggressively.
Oh yeah. I could talk all day about YouTube algorithms and recommendations. It's very frustrating as a consumer. I don't post a lot on, but we have our own channel, right? We have nearly 500,000 subscribers, and being able to like punching through the noise in the search page is really hard. It's really hard for a big channel. It's really hard for a small channel. It's just a tough business in general. So we're lucky we have Alex Dobie, who is dedicated to the craft and you know, putting out videos every week. All right, so I have to end it there, unfortunately, but I want to end the show with a segment that I think I started after the last time you came on.
Okay.
It's called What's Making Us Happy, and this is a segment that I stole directly from Pop Culture Happy Hour, which is one of my favorite podcasts. And it's anything that's making you happy, which I think is so necessary right now. Because when we think about how quickly our days go, right? I don't know what day it is. I don't know what I do in a day other than work and keep my baby alive. She's not a baby. I keep calling her a baby. She's two and
that's
a half.
That's okay. My daughter's five and she's still my little baby.
Yeah, I know. It's exactly. I mean, time goes by. Like she was a baby when this pandemic started. So it's still weird to me.
So crazy.
She's no longer. Anyway, but we started this segment because it's so important to get something, anything that just is making you happy. So I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'll put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Do you have something that is kind of like just giving you a smile these days?
Especially over the last week, two things. I kind of plugged it before, and I'll write another little love letter to the Fio BTR5. I've been using them with a pair of Mi Audio Pinnacle P1s. These are balanced, single driver earbuds. They're a little on the pricey side, but they sound real good, especially if you're like me and you don't like a lot of sort of steamrollery sub bass that kind of, you know, sort of farts all over the mids and the highs. These are from a company that makes really good professional monitors. These are just a really lovely consumer option. And my wife and I are probably the most silly, geeky, nerdy Twitter-pated that we've been for anything Marvel with WandaVision. Like in years of watching Marvel movies, she was more of like a DC comics fan. She was really into Superman growing up. I was into Batman, but like we weren't as into the Marvel comics together. But WandaVision is just like lighting up this. Oh, well, this scene here looks like this one frame from like one panel from like a comic that was released in the 80s. And oh, what they're doing here is like pulled out of like the Kirby days of this. And like it's such a lovely way to restart this giant corporate machine of Marvel. And it's the most fun we've had with anything Marvel in a while. So I'm not breaking any news there. WandaVision is absolutely lovely. And if you're into comics and you are into kind of exploring more about what the franchise and what the source material was, it really is a blast.
I agree. And I am mad at you for stealing mine.
No. Let's just we'll make
we're
it a
vibe
a
together.
Because I did too. So we'll just vibe on WandaVision, and I feel like that's
I think WandaVision. I don't remember anything from the MCU. Like, I'm one of those guys who just forgets everything about an MCU story when it finishes.
Right.
So you couldn't even ask me how, you know, Avengers Endgame ended. I don't even remember. It's in one ear and out the other. I enjoyed it while I was there, and that's it. However, I saw the pilot for WandaVision. I loved it. I watched the next four episodes in a row.
Nice.
Unstopping. It was just the most amazing binge I've had in a while. And I really am curious where they're going to take this. I saw the teaser for the episodes beyond episode five. And I guess by the time you hear this, it's likely that episode six will be out. So maybe they're in the 90s already. We'll see. But love it. It's so good. And just the combination of what's her name? Olsen. Emma Olsen?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Olsen. Elizabeth Olsen and oh my God. I always screw up names when I have to remember them.
Oh, Paul Bettany?
Yes, Paul Bettany. I saw a video today on YouTube about Paul Bettany and I still forgot his name. I'm terrible.
Oh, no worries.
Anyway, I loved him in like Master and Commander, Far Side of the World. And like I just think he's great in this. He's very dynamic. He gets to turn into a human and back to Vision. It's awesome. Anyway, my second thing, because you got two, so I'll do two as well, is I'm reading this book. It's a book that I've had on my shelf for like a long time, I think 10 years, called Manhood for Amateurs. It's by Michael Chabon. Michael Chabon wrote my favorite novel ever, which is called The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
Yes.
Which is another book about comics. But it's a book about like two best friends who make a comic together in the way that like early Marvel and DC were kind of made as just like a pet, like a love project between friends.
And then also how those people can be exploited. That book is so rich. So
it's amazing.
What are you reading now? What has he put out?
So this book, Manhood for Amateurs, is a set of essays about fatherhood. And this guy writes about parenting in the most vivid and honest way that I can imagine in these like 6 to 7 page essays. So they're very easily digestible. You can read a few of them in a sitting. And he writes about how when his son was 5, he unboxed this massive Star Wars Lego set and how different it was building these predetermined Lego sets with these like 50 page manuals versus when he was a kid in the 70s, where you just got a whole bunch of Lego blocks and you just built whatever you want. But he talks about it in a way that like, regardless of how much they ask you to follow the instructions, by the end of building a Lego set with your son, you end up building nothing. The thing that you build is nothing like what's in the manual because a kid cannot help but be imaginative and creative and unique in the way that they see these blocks. And it's just, he writes in such an evocative way. I love his writing. I love how into parenting he is because he's the kind of parent that I want to be, somebody who's there throughout their kid's entire life, entire arc. They don't let work overshadow everything else. So if you're into parenting, but you don't necessarily want to get into the sappy stuff, this is just like very, very much like his experience, his lived experience. It's called Manhood for Amateurs by Michael Chabon. So that's my recommendation this week.
I'm going to pick that one up. And again, as soon as you said Lego, I just did a Lego Hulkbuster with Lex.
Amazing.
So, and exactly to that point, on the one hand, it's like, I really want to get to the end of this process where I have this thing. Hulkbuster armors are my absolute favorite Iron Man contraptions. And so that's ever since the very first comics appearance of the Hulkbuster suit, I've just been a nut for this one thing in this one type of Iron Man storyline. But again, it's like we're getting through this process and she's wanting to put like, well, if I break off an arm from another Hulkbuster, I can put this on here. And you're like, but that's not what the instructions say.
Right.
Well, actually, let's see. Put a Gatling gun on the Hulkbuster.
Yeah,
let's
why not?
See how this goes.
It's not like some Lego cameras monitoring you building the Hulkbuster, being like, no, stop that.
I'm going to get a grade at the end of this process. No, that's not how this works.
I'm sure some kids would like a grade at the end of their Lego building process. But anyway, all right, I got to end it there. Thank you, man. This has been fantastic.
My pleasure.
I love stealing a bit of your time every once in a while just to chat about the industry and about the way things stand and about smartphones, because that's why we're here.
For sure.
For better or for worse. So appreciate your time. We will plug your stuff. It's at Some Gadget Guy and all the things. And we'll have you back again.
Always a highlight in my week when we get to have these kinds of chats, man. And especially just for catching up and for all of your audience and community out there, where I'm sure they're not told enough that your family and friends are probably leaning on you harder than ever before for being the geek in the family and knowing about all this techie stuff. You know, from I'm sure, and Daniel, you'll appreciate or join in this too. Like I feel it's on us to say thank you for being good tech neighbors and for being good tech citizens so that other people can kind of be along for this ride too.
Amen. Amen. Yeah. If you're listening, I guess you can call me is what we're saying. You can call me.
Add me to the list or tweet me something. I don't know.